Here, we enlighten you with the ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirza Tawqifi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وما تكون في شأن وما تتلو وَمَا تَتْلُو مِنْهُ مِنْ قُرْآنٍ وَلَا تَعْمَلُونَ مِنْ عَمَلٍ إِلَّا كُنَّا عَلَيْكُمْ شُهُودًا وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Quran, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater, but it is in a clear book.
Good day to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio. Good to have you with us. It's 12 noon here in Tehran, and I'm your host for the next hour. We'll start this hour's programs with our news bulletin. They will be followed by Bookshelf. The program introduces authentic and reputable Islamic books that have been written or translated into English. And we round up this hour's programs with our radio productions feature. Stay with us for this hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
reminder of our top stories. UN and Gaza officials warn that Israel's restrictions on aid entry have left thousands of people without shelter amid torrential rain and flooding. The United Nations has called on the US to allow accredited Iranian diplomats to carry out their work freely in New York. And Venezuela and Colombia have condemned as an act of piracy the US's seizure of Venezuelan oil tanker in the Caribbean. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, I am Bahman Rayan. The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has raised a serious alarm about the worsening humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza amid torrential rains and severe flooding. Philippe Lazzarini warned that the ongoing storm Byron is sharply aggravating the already dire humanitarian crisis in Gaza. He added that the storm has Gaza in its grip. Lazzarini said Palestinians who have lost everything due to war are now facing a new wave of suffering. According to the UNRWA chief, heavy rains and strong winds pose severe challenges to thousands of displaced families living in makeshift shelters made of plastic sheets and fragile material. Gaza's government media office also warned that thousands of displaced people are facing extremely harsh conditions due to lack of proper shelter and basic necessities. It said Israel continues to obstruct reconstruction efforts by restricting aid entry, exacerbating the suffering of over 1.5 million displaced people. The warnings come as Israeli forces continue to breach the Gaza ceasefire, killing 4 civilians, including a woman. The death toll from the regime's genocide now exceeds 70,300, with more than 171,000 others injured. Let us now cross over to Deir al-Balah and talk to our correspondent, Moti Abu Musabbe. Moti, over to you. What are the latest developments?
Well, unfortunately, we are talking about more chapters of the catastrophic humanitarian conditions that are still unfolding here in Gaza Strip. And as you know, 2 million Palestinian civilians are still severely and badly afflicted by these ongoing harsh conditions, particularly amid the winter deep depression that hits Gaza Strip right now. And as you know, we are talking about another harsh night for the Palestinian people. The last night was very tough and arduous for the entire population of Gaza, so particularly those who were living in their flimsy and worn-out makeshift tents scattered in all areas of Gaza. Dozens of the displacement camps were completely overflooded with the rainfall, and they were ruined and uprooted by the strong winds as well. So we are talking about more layers of suffering are still playing out for those Palestinian people. According to the last update of the Gaza civil defense system here, at least 10 Palestinian civilians died and passed away under these harsh and deadly conditions, particularly for those Palestinian babies and children, because 2 out of those 10 were babies. The last one passed away a short while ago as a result of the biting and a chilling cold in Gaza City. And as you know, this she was the second Palestinian baby to be killed by these ongoing harsh conditions. And as you know, we're talking about at least 5 Palestinian civilians were killed also in Beit Lahia City after a water wall collapsed and filled down with them. And needless to mention that several Palestinian civilians were also killed after several walls have collapsed over their heads in several parts of Gaza. And as you know, this death toll is still highly expected to rise because we are talking about a catastrophic situation on the ground here, and the civil defense teams are very crippled and they are unable to cope with the current circumstances because of the lack of the basic tools and equipment they need in order to rescue the Palestinian people. Over the past 48 hours, more than 2,500 distress calls were received by the civil defense system here in Gaza Strip, but unfortunately they are unable to do anything because they don't have the needed equipment and tools in order to help the Palestinian people or give them a hand amid these unbearable humanitarian conditions. Literally, the situation is indescribable, and no one would imagine the scale of the catastrophe here in Gaza, but the Palestinian people who are still living and experiencing the scale of this catastrophe on the ground here. Once again, I would like to remind you that what's happening on the ground right now is not taking place out of the blue. It is the normal result of the ongoing policy of the Israeli regime towards Gaza Strip, which was absolutely relying on weaponizing those humanitarian supplies against the entire population and preventing the entry of the life-saving materials and the shelter materials for the Palestinian people. And let's be clear that even if the entire population of Gaza were able to have those makeshift tents are unusable, and they are still useless here in Gaza Strip because they are unable to endure the harsh winter conditions. They are flooded, they are uprooted by the strong winds, and the Palestinian people are left to twist in the wind right now in Gaza Strip, and no hand is extended to alleviate their suffering amid these, as you know, escalating humanitarian conditions on the ground here. But unfortunately, the suffering of the Palestinian people is not limited to these harsh conditions on the ground as a result of the winter conditions, but the Israeli occupation forces on the ground continue their brutal attacks against the Palestinian people. So you cannot imagine how the Israeli occupation force are using these catastrophic humanitarian conditions in order to add more suffering on the Palestinian people on one hand, and to continue the attacks against the Palestinian people, like what happened over the last night in the eastern side of Ash-Shajaiya and Abahoud, which witnessed more bombings of the artillery strikes and shells targeting, as you know, more targeting the Palestinian residential buildings and the makeshift tents of the Palestinian people. And those, so this is how the Palestinian people are still trapped between the hammer of the ongoing violations of the ceasefire agreement and the hard place of the catastrophic and disastrous humanitarian conditions on the ground.
Right, thank you so much, Muti, for the update. Muti Abu Musabbeh joining us from Deir al-Balah. Let us now listen to several Gazans speak about their daily hardships caused by worsening humanitarian conditions.
The situation is catastrophic. First, the ground is muddy, and the tents they gave us are unsuitable for living in at all. The rainwater leaks inside, as you see. I swear, wherever I go, there are buckets and containers placed to collect water and protect the children. I am the widow of a martyr, and I have four children, the youngest of whom is 2 years old. We were unable to sleep at all last night. Water entered the tent. Were it not for the pump the municipality provided, which eased our suffering a little, it would have been worse. But we need proper tents for living. We need basic necessities in the camp to support us, like winter clothing for our children.
The truth is, we live this way every single day. Every time winter comes, we face continuous suffering. In summer, things are a little better, but now it's unbearable.
As you see, all my food and water were soaked. And this bathroom, look, no one can live in this tent. This tarpaulin is not suitable for living. We spend the entire night suffering. Our children are small, and I suffer from injury and illness caused by the occupation. Praise be to God. We hope first from God, then from Islamic and Arab nations, and from anyone with a living conscience, to look at the situation of these poor and needy people.
Rights groups have slammed Israel over the situation in the regime's prisons, saying that deteriorating conditions and systematic neglect are causing death of Palestinian abductees. This came after a new report revealed that 110 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli jails since far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir took office in December 2022. Gad Abraham reports.
At least 110 Palestinian abductees have been killed while in Israeli detention. That's according to a new report. It said many of the detainees are regularly subjected to torture, assault, medical neglect, and malnutrition.
After October 7th, Israel's systematic violence and torture against Palestinian prisoners increased rapidly, and this is not only reflected by the increase of fatalities, but also in the witnesses we hear from and the ex-prisoners. Gaza's prisoners are still subjected to more brutal and inhumane treatment, which was noticed more clearly since Ben-Gvir came into office. His policies are reflecting his own extremism.
Ben-Gvir, who oversees Israel's prison system, openly boasts about rising fatalities in Israeli jails. Those close to Ben-Gvir maintain that the hawkish Israeli minister is proud to have aggravated conditions for Palestinian abductees.
I was in prison for nearly 2 years, during which I was subjected to extreme torture and medical neglect. For 4 months, I had scabies, and they refused to give any medicine. Starvation was another method of torture. We would go for days without food, or with the minimum that kept us alive. We witnessed the death of many people inside the prison. One prisoner was Dr. Mossab Hania, who was tortured to death for his last name only.
In addition to the 18,500 documented arrests since October 2023, there are an unknown number taken as part of an Israeli policy of enforced disappearances. 2 years on, thousands of those disappeared from Gaza may no longer be alive. For the 110 Palestinian prisoners who never made it home, the suffering may have ended. However, for the thousands who are still behind the Israeli bars, the agony persists. Gad Ibrahim, Deir al-Balah City, Palestine.
Israeli forces and settlers continue to launch violent attacks against Palestinians across the occupied West Bank, injuring civilians and vandalizing their property. In the city of Jenin, the Israeli forces shot a Palestinian doctor in the thigh while he was leaving a funeral. The incident coincided with renewed settler raids into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Al-Quds. The Israeli forces also raided the village of Beitin, northeast of Ramallah. Meanwhile, settlers continue to expand illegal outposts by adding new mobile homes to a settlement built on Mount Sabeh, south of Nablus. Since the genocide in Gaza began, more than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed, and over 20,000, that includes 1,600 children, abducted in the West Bank. Hundreds of protesters have rallied outside the UK Prime Minister's residence in London to urge the government to intervene in the case of hunger-striking Palestine Action prisoners. Protesters said at least 7 inmates across 5 prisons have refused food for up to 38 days, with an 8th fasting on alternate days despite being diabetic. We have talked to some of the demonstrators, and here's what they said.
Hunger strikers who are still on remand after a year are still on hunger strike, and the situation has not been resolved. To my knowledge, no meeting has been made with David Lammy, who should be taking action on this. The health of the hunger strikers deteriorates day on day, to the point where it's really quite serious now. It's life-changing.
President Pezeshkian says the Israeli aggression against Iran in June was the result of a special privilege granted to the Tel Aviv regime. Speaking at the International Peace and Trust Forum in Turkmenistan's capital, Pezeshkian slammed the world powers for creating a framework of security exceptionalism for Israel. He added that based on that exceptionalism and injustices, the Israeli regime dared to attack Iran in June, killing hundreds of civilians. The Iranian president emphasized that no country, even the world powers, should act beyond international norms and laws. He stressed Iran's support for any effort that strengthens peace, security and global development. The Ashgabat Forum, marking the International Year of Peace and Trust, hosts UN member states, bodies, international organizations, as well as civil society representatives. The United Nations has called on the U.S. to lift restrictions on Iranian diplomats in New York. It says accredited diplomats should be allowed to carry out their work freely. The call was issued by UN Deputy Spokesman Farhan Haq. He reaffirmed the world body's stance that the U.S. as a host country is obligated to permit unrestricted movements of all UN-based diplomatic personnel. The remarks came after Tehran urged the UN to intervene in what it called the tightening of restrictions on its diplomatic mission. Iran's foreign ministry said Washington abused its, quote, host country status by imposing restrictions on the residents, movement, banking access and even daily purchases of Iranian diplomats. Iran has condemned the seizure of a Venezuelan oil tanker by the U.S. in the Caribbean, calling it state-sponsored maritime piracy. Foreign Ministry spokesman Ismail Baghaei said the seizure of commercial vessels belonging to other nations by the U.S. is in clear defiance of international law. Baghaei stressed that invoking U.S. domestic laws or its illegal sanctions to justify this measure cannot change the illegal and criminal nature of this armed maritime robbery. He also warned about the impact of such forceful measures on international peace, security and trade. Baghaei noted that all governments and international organizations are responsible to oppose such illegal measures and hold Washington responsible. In a similar reaction, Colombian President Gustavo Petro denounced the U.S.'s seizure of a Venezuelan tanker as an act of piracy.
They just seized a ship. It is oil piracy. It is oil. In other words, they are showing why they are doing what they are doing, oil, oil, and more oil. But oil is about to die as a driver of economic development for our peoples. So we have to think about another kind of development, what to do. We cannot have the same military power, we cannot have the same financial power, but we can have other kinds of power, and one of them starts here, joining forces. I told Trump, brother, you are teaming up with drug traffickers, you are even pardoning them, and instead you are attacking the ones who could actually help you if your real goal were to defeat drug trafficking. Who knows the Caribbean better than we do? Who knows Colombia better than Colombian men and women? Who is better than Colombia at seizing hundreds of tons of cocaine without killing anyone? But that is not what they care about. What they want is control of the Caribbean.
Thank you so much for staying with us.
Thank you. 7. Very much pressure.
We come to you, and oh God, knowing that thou art our only King.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Thank you for joining us again. You're listening to IRIB English Radio, and you're listening to The Bookshelf. We have an awesome book for you today, The Seven Story Mountain by Thomas Merton. Have you ever wondered what it means to search for true meaning in a life full of distractions, doubts, and worldly desires? Thomas Merton's The Seven Story Mountain invites us into that search. It's a spiritual autobiography tracing his journey from a restless youth to a Trappist monk devoted to God, a story of awakening, vocation, and the pursuit of a life aligned with purpose. Merton writes with honesty and vulnerability, sharing his struggles, doubts, and the transformative experiences that guided him towards monastic life. Through his narrative, we witness both his inner life, his contemplations, fears, and spiritual insights, and his external journey through the challenges and decisions that led him to surrender to a higher calling. The book gives us a window into the profound tension between worldly desires and the call to spiritual life, and the sacrifices and rewards that come with answering that call. At its heart, the book explores themes of spiritual awakening, vocation, and personal transformation. Merton illustrates that true growth often requires letting go of familiar comforts and embracing uncertainty. He shows us that surrendering to a higher purpose is not a loss of self, but a path to fulfillment, clarity, and connection with the divine. Each chapter becomes the reflection on how life can be reshaped when one commits to values, discipline, and faith. Philosophically, Merton emphasizes that true fulfillment comes from living in alignment with spiritual principles, cultivating reflection and committing to devotion. He invites readers to consider their own paths, to examine the ways in which vocation and faith can guide choices, and to explore what it means to live intentionally. So why would you read Seven Story Mountain? Because it offers insight into the spiritual journey, showing both challenges and rewards of following one's calling, and resonates with anyone seeking purpose, direction of understanding of how to align life with values and faith. After the break, let's read a part from this book.
IRIB English Radio.
Prisoner's base on the last day of January 1915, under the sign of the Water Bearer, in a year of great war, and down in the shadow of some French mountains on the borders of Spain, I came into the world. Free by nature in the image of God, I was nevertheless the prisoner of my own violence and my own selfishness. In the image of the world into which I was born, that world was a picture of hell, full of men like myself, loving God and yet hating him, born to love him, living instead in fear and hopeless self-contradictory hungers. Not many hundreds of miles away from the house where I was born, they were picking up the men who rotted in the rainy ditches among the dead horses and the ruined 75s in a forest of trees without branches, along the River Marne. My father and mother were captives in that world, knowing they did not belong with it or in it, and yet unable to get away from it. They were in the world and not of it, not because they were saints, but in a different way, because they were artists. The integrity of an artist lifts a man above the level of the world without delivering him from it. It did not take very much reflection on the year I had spent at Cambridge to show me that all my dreams of fantastic pleasures and delights were crazy and absurd, and that everything I had reached out for had turned to ashes in my hands, and that I myself, into the bargain, had turned out to be an extremely unpleasant sort of person. Vain, self-centered, dissolute, weak, irresolute, undisciplined, sensual, obscene, and proud. I was a mess. Even the sight of my own face in a mirror was enough to disgust me. When I came to ask myself the reasons for all this, the ground was well prepared. My mind was already facing what seemed to be an open door out of my spiritual jail. It was some 4 years since I had first read the Communist Manifesto, and I had never entirely forgotten about it. One of those Christmas vacations at Strasbourg, I had read some books about Soviet Russia, how all the factories were working overtime, and all the ex-mujiks wore great big smiles on their faces, welcoming Russian aviators on their return from polar flights, bearing the boughs of trees in their hands. Then I often went to Russian movies, which were pretty good from the technical point of view, although probably not so good as I thought they were, in my great anxiety to approve of them. Finally, I had in my mind the myth that Soviet Russia was the friend of all the arts and the only place where true art could find a refuge in a world of bourgeois ugliness. Wherever I got that idea is hard to find out, and how I managed to cling to it for so long is harder still, when you consider all the photographs there were for everyone to see, showing the Red Square with gigantic pictures of Stalin hanging on the walls of the world's ugliest buildings, not to mention the views of the projected monster monument to Lenin, like the huge mountain of soap sculpture and the little father of communism standing on top of it and sticking out one of his hands. Then, when I went to New York in the summer, I found the new masses lying around the studios of my friends. And as a matter of fact, a lot of the people I met were either party members or close to being so. So now, when the time came for me to take the spiritual stock of myself, it was natural that I should do so by projecting my whole spiritual condition into the sphere of economic history and the class struggle. In other words, the conclusion I came to was that it was not so much I myself was to blame for my unhappiness, but the society in which I lived. I considered the person that I now was the person that I had been at Cambridge and that I had made of myself. And I saw clearly enough that I was a product of my times, my society, and my class. I was something that had been spawned by the selfishness and irresponsibility of the materialistic century in which I lived. The months passed quickly, but not quickly enough for me. Already, it was June 1940, the 2 months that remained until the date in August when the doors of the novitiate would open to receive 30 or 40 new postulants seemed infinitely far away. I did not stay long in New York when I came back from Cuba. I was there only a few days, in which I went to the monastery on the 31st Street and learned from Father Edmund that my application for admission had been accepted and that some of the necessary papers had arrived. It was a very good thing that this was so, because the postulants entering a religious order need documents from every diocese where they have lived for a morally continuous year since their 14th year, as well as a birth certificate and a lot of other things as well. But this was precisely the time when the German armies were pouring into France. At the moment when I stepped off the boat in New York, they had made their first great break through the French lines, and it had at last become obvious that the impregnable defense of the Maginot Line was a myth. Indeed, it was only a matter of a very few days before the fierce armored divisions of the Nazis following in the path broke out before them by the Luftwaffe, pierced the demoralized French army, and embraced the betrayed nations in arms of steel. They had Paris within a fortnight, and then they were at the Loire, and finally the papers were full of blurred wire photos of the dumb isolated dining car in the park of Compiègne, where Hitler made the French eat the document on which the 1918 armistice had been written. So too, if my father and mother's marriage certificate from St. Anne's in Soho, London, had not come in that year, it might never have come at all. I don't know if the parish records of St. Anne survived the blitzkrieg that was about to be let loose over the heads of the huge dark city full of sins and miseries in whose fogs I had once walked with such wise complacency. But everything seemed clear. A month would go by, and then another, and soon I would be walking with my suitcase up some drab, unimaginable street in Paterson, New Jersey. You've been listening to IRIB English Radio. This was The Bookshelf with Nasreen Sayed, and we've been reading from The Seven-Story Mountain by Thomas Merton. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you will join us again next time.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
May peace, blessings, and God's mercy be with you all. Everything mentioned so far serves merely as an example of the manifestations, outcomes, and some consequences of direct American hegemony over Iraq since the military invasion in 2003, particularly in the economic, financial, and oil sectors. Having examined the background and causes of this domination, we will now delve into the origins of comprehensive American hegemony over Iraq and its roots. For over a century, although the occupiers of our lands have changed and the slogans and justifications for occupation and invasion have evolved, the fundamental goal remains unchanged: to dominate our territories, their resources, and the Arab world. This reality is not exclusive to Iraq, but extends throughout the entire region, from British and French colonialism after World War I to American hegemony in both its old and modern forms. The American hegemony in Iraq is an extension of colonial history. The U.S. intervention did not start with the 2003 invasion or the sanctions imposed in 1990. The true American hegemony has lasted for over 70 years. Although it was not exhaustive or complete at the beginning, it specifically began with the precursors to the establishment of the Baghdad Pact in 1955. Even though the United States was not a partner in the pact, it did support it. This agreement was established under the pretext of confronting communist movements and Arab nationalism led by Egypt under the leadership of Gamal Abdel Nasser. If we look further back, even before the Baghdad Pact, we can assert that the strategy of American hegemony has been deeply entrenched. Even Noam Chomsky, in an article titled Modern American Imperialism, the Middle East and Beyond, published on April 24, 2008, traces the history of American hegemony back to before the Spanish-American War of 1898, suggesting that the United States is inherently a hegemonic power, as we discussed in previous episodes, most recent one being on November 28, 2025, titled The United States in Our Lands, Neither to Defend Israel Nor to Confront Iran. Looking back a bit in history to analyze the roots of the global hegemony that led to the domination of Iraq, imperialism began its transformation from its classical form in the 19th century, shifting from traditional military occupation to a global system of economic and political dominance. At the start of this transformation, powers like Germany, Japan, and the United States emerged to compete with Great Britain and other European nations for influence. Europe was thrust into a frantic race for the division of Africa and the control of markets and finances. These factors, along with others, led to the outbreak of World War I. After this war, the Treaty of Versailles marked a second phase of imperialism aimed at dividing the spoils and confronting communism. However, this project was interrupted by the Great Depression, which began with the collapse of the U.S. stock market in 1929 and World War II. With the conclusion of World War II, the leadership of colonial powers shifted from Great Britain to the United States. The United States later developed the Greater Middle East Initiative, a plan aimed at ensuring complete control over the strategic centers of the global economy under the guise of openness and free trade. This shift in leadership saw American imperialism take on new forms, such as international financial institutions, the monetary system, military alliances, and indirect interventions. Control over nations began to be exercised under the pretense of global order, no longer labeled as occupation. Focusing specifically on Iraq, Following the end of World War I and the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, Britain discovered a geographical and economic treasure. It occupied Iraq in 1917 and established a mandate system endorsed by the League of Nations. However, the truth is that this mandate was nothing more than a form of real colonialism disguised as a diplomatic document with a dedication signed by the League of Nations. London solidified its control over Iraqi oil through the Iraq Petroleum Company, shaping the modern state's map to serve its strategic interests. This design involved imposing a foreign king, Faisal I, and establishing an army primarily tasked with protecting the British crown rather than ensuring the safety of the Iraqi people. Despite popular uprisings in Iraq, particularly the 1920 revolution, Britain maintained its grip through political treaties, economic dominance, military presence, and infiltration of the ruling elites. In this way, Iraq emerged as a nominally independent and sovereign state, but in practice, it was subordinate to the British crown. After the conclusion of World War II, Washington stepped onto the stage, taking advantage of the decline of the British Empire and the rise of the United States as a global power. Iraq became a crucial piece in the conflict between East and West. The United States supported the Baghdad Pact in 1955, seemingly to contain the Soviet Union, and attempted to infiltrate the Iraqi army and administration. It employed political and media tools to undermine any nationalist projects that threatened its interests, particularly in the oil sector. With the 1958 revolution and the fall of the monarchy, it seemed that Iraq was beginning to break free from its colonial legacy. Despite its shift towards Arab nationalism or its adoption of this under the leadership of Abdel Karim Qasim and later the Ba'ath Party, Iraq remained a constant testing ground for American influence. This was exerted through conditional aid, intelligence agencies, and even through the manipulation of the head of state himself, such as Saddam, whom Washington used in the 1980s as a tool against Iran before he became a target to eliminate. Since the mid-20th century, the United States' policy towards Iraq has had a consistent goal to keep the country within its regional and global interests and to prevent Iraq from becoming an independent state that could pose a potential threat to those interests. The methods used have been diverse, ranging from covert interventions to economic pressures, military dominance, and control over institutions. Nevertheless, the ultimate aim has always remained the same, to ensure U.S. access to vital resources, especially oil, and to keep Iraq within the sphere of American influence. The initial tools of hegemony were intelligence and covert intervention. In the 1950s and 1960s, there were signs of U.S. support for elements and factions within the Iraqi army and for political movements capable of shifting the internal balance of power when necessary. We recall here the U.S. role in the Ba'ath Party coup and its rise to power in 1963. Another tool, both then and now, is tactical and economic support for regimes or leaders with whom collaboration can be established to achieve U.S. interests. For instance, in the 1980s, with the outbreak of Saddam's war against Iran, the United States reopened diplomatic and commercial channels with Iraq. The United States reopened diplomatic and commercial channels with Baghdad, providing intelligence data, indirect support, and at times direct assistance to Saddam's regime. If covert influence or alliances failed, Washington would turn to economic power, international pressure, and even military force. Following Saddam's invasion of Kuwait in 1990, an international military campaign led by the United States was launched under the banner of liberating Kuwait. Although the stated goal was to free an independent state, the real aim was to control another country and ultimately establish a permanent military presence in the Persian Gulf while securing its oil. Washington led a massive coalition and enforced a suffocating embargo on Iraq for 13 years. This embargo devastated the infrastructure, weakened society, and paved the way for a phase of total domination. Programs like Oil for Food illustrated how international restrictions limited and fragmented the Iraqi state's ability to manage the resources of the Iraqi people. In 2003, the U.S. invasion of Iraq became the most perilous step due to the negative consequences for Iraq, its people, and the entire region. The project to strangle and control Iraq was based on the falsehood of spreading democracy and misleading claims of weapons of mass destruction. The American forces burst into Iraq to overthrow the regime, and the Iraqis stayed within weeks. The Iraqi army was disbanded, institutions were dismantled, and the doors were wide open to sectarianism, corruption, and the systematic plundering of wealth. In reality, the American occupation of Iraq was the culmination of a century of colonial policies. Among the strategies employed by Washington was political control through a quota system that ensured the division and fragmentation of the elite, thereby preventing the establishment of an Iraqi state modeled after a unified national state. Secondly, economic dominance is achieved through the privatization of a significant portion of the public sector and the connection of Iraq to international financial institutions. This results in the Iraqi economy becoming reliant on debt and imports. Thirdly, military and security influence is achieved through the training and equipping of the army and security forces, the establishment of permanent military bases, and the signing of strategic partnership agreements. Fourthly, cultural and media penetration is achieved through the promotion of the liberal democracy model based on American standards, along with support from media networks and civil society organizations that are funded to sway public opinion. In fifth place, the management of natural resources is carried out, particularly regarding oil, through long-term contracts that ensure the ongoing control of Western companies over every production and marketing. In sixth place, support is provided to sectarian, regional, tribal, or clan parties and leaders with the aim of fragmenting the political landscape and limiting the space for inclusive national action. In seventh place, international institutions, particularly the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Bank, WB, are used to dictate the terms of reconstruction and debt, imposing structural economic reforms that undermine the Iraqi state's ability to make independent decisions. As noted, the American plan and methods for domination over Iraq are an extension of the country's colonial history. Furthermore, they are a crucial part of the Greater Middle East project, a long-term strategic vision that the United States began to articulate after the Cold War and which solidified following the events of September 11, 2001. The aim of this project is to reshape the political, economic, and social geography of the countries in the region, which stretches from Morocco to Pakistan. This initiative has ancient roots and was developed by a group of American diplomats, economists, and thinkers. The initial outlines emerged in the 1990s with the New World Order speech delivered by George H.W. Bush following the collapse of the Soviet Union. This plan evolved into an official project under the leadership of George W. Bush in 2004, which was formalized as the Greater Middle East and North Africa Initiative. The stated goal was to promote democracy and political and economic reforms in the Arab and Islamic world, but the underlying aim was to reshape the map of influence and borders to benefit U.S. hegemony. Additionally, the aim was to connect the target countries to a unified network of economic and security interests, naturally led by Washington, so that this vast region could become an alternative sphere of U.S. strategic influence to ensure its global dominance against China. This project also has implicit goals, particularly the dismantling of major central states like Iraq, Syria, Sudan, Egypt, and Iran into smaller sectarian or ethnic entities to facilitate their control. Additionally, there is a constant goal of ensuring Israel's security by dismantling the powerful neighboring states and transforming the Arab-Israeli conflict from an existential liberation struggle against the colonial power into a mere cultural and developmental issue. This, of course, secures Israel's safety as the primary tool of hegemony over the countries in the region. Thirdly, another implicit goal is to manage energy resources, oil and gas, through subordinate regimes or Western companies. It's important to note that this objective is openly discussed by thinkers, researchers, and some U.S. officials. Fourthly, it's essential to contain China, Russia, and Iran, preventing any Asian-Eurasian axis from competing with Washington in the strategic waterways of the Persian Gulf, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, the Suez Canal, and the Mediterranean. Fifthly, one of the key objectives is also to re-engineer the political and social culture within Arab societies through media, education, and civil organizations. Since the U.S. invasion of Iraq in the spring of 2003, this war has been more than just a territorial or regime struggle. It's been a battle over the very meaning of sovereignty. Iraq was not only invaded by armies, but also by ideas, promises, debts, and structures specifically designed to hinder its recovery. The occupation marked the beginning of a new phase and a different form of American hegemony, where military control evolved into a continuous system renewed through various tools, including military bases, oil contracts, financial influence, and a democracy directed and managed from abroad. Prominent American thinkers point out military force alone does not create legitimacy, and imposing control does not equate to achieving stability. The Iraq that Washington aimed to subjugate is the same Iraq that revealed the fragility of its imperial project when the invasion turned into a strategic burden. However, empires do not easily surrender and always replace their tools with new ones that allow them to maintain their overall dominance, albeit in different ways than before. Today, more than two decades after the fall of Baghdad, the most pressing question remains. Has Iraq truly freed itself from occupation, or has its captivity merely been reconfigured within a global system that denies it full sovereignty? The answer is not straightforward. The United States will not allow Iraq to easily respond to this question through complete liberation and genuine independence without resistance. However, it is true that the journey towards true independence is not solely measured by the withdrawal of armies, but by the ability of people to break the chains of hegemony, whether they are visible or hidden. I'll see you next week, inshallah, for a new episode.
Waking up for Fajr, gotta make wudu, gotta pray my sunnah. Got me ghuskal, clip my nails. Looking outside, the sun is rising. Up in the sky, everybody's rushing. Gotta get down to the masjid. Gotta say salam to the imam. Sitting in the first saf, chilling in the back saf. Gotta make my mind up, do what the prophet did. It's Juma, Juma. Gotta make thinking on Juma. Everybody's looking forward to his mercy, mercy. Juma, Juma, gotta make thinking on Juma. Everybody's looking forward to the edger. Miss Wacken, Miss Wacken, yeah! Miss Wacken, Miss Wacken, whoa! Pray, 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 pray. Gotta read Surah the Kahf. 12:45, the imam's on the minbar, talking about something like fiqh as a cat. They're whispering, chatting from the crowd. Don't they know that it's haram? I stand up, you stand up. Praise about to start by the qamat yusalah. Foot to foot, shoulder to shoulder. Just don't step on me. Sitting in the first saf, chilling in the back saf. Gotta make my mind up, do what the prophet did. It's Juma, Juma. Gotta make thinking on Juma. Everybody's looking forward to his mercy, mercy. Juma, Juma, gotta make thinking on Juma. Everybody's looking forward to the edger. Miss
miswacking, miswacking. Whoa. Pray, 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 pray. Gotta read Surah Al-Kahf. It's Jumu'ah, Jumu'ah. Gotta make thinking on Jumu'ah. Everybody's looking forward to his mercy, mercy. Jumu'ah, Jumu'ah. Gotta make thinking on Jumu'ah. Everybody's looking forward to his mercy.
Good day to all of our listeners from around the world. This is Iran Radio broadcasting from Tehran, and I'm your presenter for the next hour. We start off this hour's programs with Middle East Stream. The program analyzes the latest developments in occupied Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria. And we round up this hour's programs with insights into the Holy Quran. The program presents a short exegesis and explanation of the ayahs of the Holy Quran, and we round up this hour's programs with our varied radio productions feature. Stay with us for the next hour.
Midstream.
Good evening, and to all who still believe in dignity, resistance, and a Lebanon that will not be sold out, listen carefully. We are told now, let's bring civilians into the security mechanism. Civilians to monitor what? While bombs still fall? While occupation continues? Enter the self-appointed referees of our fate, envoys from abroad planting their smiles, signatures next to civilian envoy to the ceasefire committee. And yet, conveniently, not a single mention that Lebanon was made limp on purpose through bombs and occupation, that its currency was strangled, its economy mortgaged, its future mortgaged, all under the golden banners of aid and reform. This is why Hezbollah is right to draw the red line. Sheikh Naim Qasim did not mince words. Admitting a civilian delegate into the so-called mechanism is a free concession, a handout to Zionist Israel with no return, no leverage, nothing but humiliation. Because when you sit at the same table as your enemy under foreign management, you don't negotiate dignity, you bargain it away. They'll tell you this is politics, this is diplomacy, but we know what it really is, a cover-up, a subtle laundering of occupation under the guise of talks, committees, mechanisms, all to smooth the road for more aggression, more occupation, more suffering. And then America's envoy shows up loud in his condemnation. Lebanon is a failed state, Tom Barak says, as if the failure just fell from the sky, as if there was no foreign siege, no IMF debts, no looting of savings, no engineered collapse, as if the rubble around us is self-inflicted. He speaks of disarmament as if resistance is the problem, as if the rockets defending villages and towns are more dangerous than the jets raining down bombs. He regrets that there is no civil war in Lebanon, as though the eruption of Lebanese blood would please some dark agenda. It is arrogance. It is hypocrisy. It is the posture of a colonizer who punches you while lecturing you about peace. So yes, Hezbollah rejects this mechanism, not because it fears negotiation, but because it refuses surrender dressed up as diplomacy. To all those who hope that by repackaging surrender in a civilian suit, one can parlay into peace, know this. Peace cannot be sown under rubble. Resistance is not the disease. It is the vaccine. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Mara Osman. Hezbollah has made its position crystal clear. No civilians will be dragged into security mechanisms while Israeli entity hostilities continue.
Meanwhile, U.S. envoys lecture Lebanon on failure, ignoring decades of foreign interference that have deliberately weakened the country. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Omar Nashebi, lawyer, expert in human rights and political commentator. It's a pleasure having you with us, Dr. Omar. Now, how does Hezbollah's rejection of civilian participation in the proposed mechanism reflect its broader strategy to try and preserve Lebanon's sovereignty and the credibility of its own resistance?
Yes, good morning, and thank you for having me. Hezbollah has accepted the Resolution 1701, which is the resolution by the UN Security Council. Hezbollah also accepted to withdraw from south of the Litani River and have no military presence there. Hezbollah also recognized UNIFIL's role, the United Nations peacekeeping force in southern Lebanon, and it accepted also that Lebanon does these negotiations that are technical through army officers. Now, having accepted all that, and the Israelis continue